Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC, and with Come to My Window by Melissa Etheridge, we continue our series, Prejudice and Pride, Decade by Decade Since Stonewall, with archival audio and guests, and we'll continue to take lots of your oral history calls today, Prejudice and LGBT Pride in the 1990s. For one thing, putting a hoped-for ally into the highest office of the land. Here's a news report on what the, quote, gays thought about Bill Clinton from an NBC Universal Archives news report from 1992.
We're here! We're here! We're going to the White House!
For the first time in a race for the White House, gay and lesbian issues were an important part of the campaign.
We can't afford to waste the capacities, the contributions, the hearts, the souls, and the minds of the gay and lesbian Americans either.
Like these lesbians and gays in Atlanta, they got into the political process in a big way.
We've contributed, we think, about $3 million to the Democratic effort this year. We've got something like 10,000 volunteers through our organization's efforts and through other organizations' efforts all over the country. We have 350 volunteers here just in the Atlanta area who have been working since June.
I think one of the reasons that the gay and lesbian community has matured into a major force in American politics is the fact that 150,000 people died of AIDS.
For the first time in history, we have a gay and lesbian voting bloc. This has never happened before. A lot of that credit is due to Bill Clinton himself.
So that NBC News report after the election of 1992. In that same decade, LGBT culture found a place in living rooms all over the country. First, Ellen DeGeneres came out on mainstream American television in her character Ellen Morgan in the ABC sitcom Ellen. Here she is from the super famous puppy episode in 1997.
This is so hard, but I think I've realized that I am, I can't even say the word. Why can't I say the word? I mean, why can't I just say, I mean, what is wrong? That why do I have to be so ashamed? I mean, why can't I just say the truth? I mean, be who I am. I'm 35 years old. I'm so afraid to tell people. I mean, I just, Susan, I'm gay.
So that iconic moment was in 97. And when Ellen went off the air in 1998, Will and Grace made its debut. And that show centered on a gay, sometimes closeted Will and his straight friend Grace had supporting characters who stole the show. Here are Jack and Karen, best friends of Will and Grace, meeting for the first time during season one in 1998.
Well, I borrowed this tassel from Grace like 2 months ago and I never returned it.
You borrowed one tassel for what?
Let's just say a lamp.
Okay, come on, honey. Stick around. Talk to me. I have nothing to do today. Grace is taking the day off to move.
Not where you think. Shoes?
Chanel.
Fabulous.
I know. Honey, what are you telling me?
Will is asking her to move in with him.
Honey, no, no. She can't move into his place. That's not acceptable.
Tell me about it, you feisty little shih tzu.
Is she ever going to get married if she's playing house with a gay guy? No offense. Just guessing.
Just guessing. Jack is out and proud, and the series had a long-running joke that Karen was actually a bisexual. Speaking of which, the 1990s were a big year for the B, a big decade, I should say, for the B in LGBT. The bisexual pride flag was designed by Michael Page in 1998 to give the community its own symbol. If you don't know it, it's pink on top, blue on the bottom, and the covers overlap in the middle to make a purple, representing attraction anywhere along the gender spectrum. And according to GLAAD, the civil rights group, the 1990s were marked by efforts to include bisexuals as a represented group within the gay and lesbian community. By 1993, bisexuals were officially included in the platform for the March on Washington for what was called in that year, lesbian, gay, and bi equal rights and liberation, as the acronym LGBTQ began to take shape. And Hillary Swank rounded off the decade of LGBT community in the mainstream when she won the Oscar for Best Actress for her 1999 film, Boys Don't Cry. The film was adapted from the life of Brandon Tina, a transgender man who was raped and murdered in Nebraska in 1993. Here is Swank accepting her Oscar.
Last but certainly not least, I want to thank Brandon Tina for being such an inspiration to us all. His legacy lives on through our movie to remind us to always be ourselves, to follow our hearts, to not conform. I pray for the day when we not only accept our differences, but we actually celebrate our diversity.
Hillary Swank at the year 2000 Oscar ceremonies for the film in 99. Of course, a central part of this series, folks, all week is your oral history calls. They've been amazing so far. Keep them coming. We'll focus on a different decade each show through the end of the week. And so our oral history question for today, for any lesbian or bisexual listeners, as we focus on Ellen and some of the bi movement of the 1990s, also trans men who were around at the time, what was it like to see yourselves reflected in shows like Ellen, Will and Grace, and the Oscar-winning film Boys Don't Cry? Did you see yourselves reflected anywhere else in popular culture, either positively or negatively? How did it impact your coming out? Tell us a story that's an important memory for you from the 1990s at 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. We've been trying to emphasize call-ins from different groups of people that kind of correspond to the news events of the different decades. So we had a lot of lesbian callers for the 70s. We had a lot of gay men callers for the 80s. We're definitely inviting people who might have come out as bi or realized you were bi in the 1990s right now. 212-433-WNYC, or any lesbians for whom the Ellen moment in particular, or other suddenly more positive representations in mainstream media made a difference to you. 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692. And as your calls are coming in, we have Claire Potter, professor of history at the New School and executive editor of Public Seminar. Professor Potter, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me, Brian. Great to see you.
So let's back up and go chronologically through a few of the clips we played. The first one was of LGBTQ community members coming together to help put Bill Clinton in office. What did Bill Clinton, the candidate, represent to them?
Well, speaking very personally, I remember Bill Clinton accepting the nomination and using the words lesbian and gay for the first time at a Democratic nominating convention, and I burst into tears. And it seems like a trivial thing, but to be recognized on a national stage, particularly at a moment where the LGBT community had been fighting AIDS for almost 12 years, with very little help from local politicians, opposition from the church, to have a candidate for president stand up for us was overwhelming.
And one of the things about the early Clinton years, really the early Clinton days, I should say, is that one of his first moves was to lift the ban on, quote, gays in the military, but that ended with a compromise known as Don't Ask, Don't Tell, after a backlash. And I think people don't know that history. They say, oh, Don't Ask, Don't Tell, Clinton, halfway measure. But that's not where it started, right?
Well, that's not where it started. And of course, gays and lesbians had been banned from the military since World War II. And any sort of slip up could actually get someone a dishonorable discharge, which is actually a very serious thing to carry around with you, even today. And multiple reports had been done at the Pentagon about whether lesbians and gays could adequately serve in the military. Multiple reports said actually we were all overachievers. And yet the political pressure to not have out gays and lesbians was very strong. I would also say 1992 is the year that Patrick J. Buchanan gives his culture war speech at the Republican National Convention, in which he says, you know, the liberalization of American society has to stop, and it has to stop now. And he really begins the populist wave that crests over the next 20 years. There's enormous pushback in the 1990s, even as there are victories. I do want to say in 1991, the first out gay city council members are elected in New York, Tom Duane and Antonio Pagan. And Tom Duane becomes the first politician in the United States to serve openly as someone with AIDS as well.
Though part of the backlash was the Defense of Marriage Act. And that was
absolutely
a full 15 years and more before the Supreme Court was to declare marriage a civil right,
right.
Constitutional right.
So there's a big struggle in 1990, and a big part of it is organized around Hawaii's right to marry that emerges in 1991.
They were the first state?
The first state. And there's a huge backlash against them. Eventually, Hawaiian voters repeal that. But we begin to see the marriage movement emerging in the 1990s, in part as a response to the marginalization of gay people, the ways in which the stigma of AIDS has become sharper, but also the ways in which AIDS makes gay and lesbian people realize how unbelievably legally vulnerable we are without marriage. And so the push to actually mainstream LGBT life through marriage, through parenting, and so on, is constantly met by this pushback by a growingly radical conservative movement to say, no, you are not like us at all.
Listeners, your oral history calls from the 1990s tell us a story of coming out, of seeing people like you represented positively in the mainstream media for the first time in some cases, or whatever you remember. 212-433-9692. And Wanda in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Wanda.
Hi. It's so exciting for me to think about the 1990s. I was in my 30s in 1997 when Ellen came out, and it was amazing to see myself represented in the mainstream media. I was somebody who had been living as a straight person for many years and struggling with the idea that that was a possibility, despite the fact that I had many people in my life personally who were gay. But then seeing somebody who I loved, you know, showing herself to be a part of that community, the gay community, was just, it was huge. So, and there was a group of us who met at a very special place that was called Identity House, where, you know, there were women who were 21 years old to 60 years old in the mid-90s who were still struggling with coming out. So, you know, seeing being representative in mainstream media was a really big step in feeling very accepted.
Thank you so much for that memory. Jenny Livingston, the director, calling from Brooklyn. You're on WNYC. Thank you so much for calling in.
Yay. Well, I love the show.
Thank
you. I'm happy to call in. So Paris is Burning, the film I made that was released in 91, is now in re-release at the Film Forum where it had its debut. The film was made by New York audiences who hadn't seen images of LGBT, African-American, and Latinx, trans and queer community, the ball world. And the images we made back then really mattered. It was hard to make independent films that were queer back then. The money wasn't forthcoming. People didn't think there were gay audiences or LGBT audiences, didn't think straight people would want to see images of our lives, which is, I think, really, you know, selling straight people short in terms of, you know, like everyone sees images of aliens and, you know, images of past historical eras. Why wouldn't straight people mm-hmm. be able to see gay stories?
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, this film has moved forward, and my film and other films of that era of the 90s have engendered RuPaul's Drag Race and Pose and other TV shows and films that happened because we, you know, had the faith that we could somehow get those films made. And just last week, in a professional setting, a woman I didn't know turned to me, actually in a restroom, knew who I was, and said, she's an African-American woman. She said, I'm trans. I saw your film. It changed my life. Mm. So the images that we put out and that we as audiences support really make a difference in people's lives.
And that's great that it's out at Film Forum right now for people to see on a big screen if they never saw it or see it again. How much do you think changed in the decade of the 90s since Paris is Burning came out early in the decade in 91? And I hear what you're saying about how films that took risks like yours paved the way for others to feel it was safe or for studios to feel they could be profitable. How much changed over the course of that decade?
I think it changed a lot, but I think it changed slowly, you know. And I think what's happening now, you know, the explosion in the golden age of television, both in nonfiction and fiction, it was slow growing. You know, I don't think by 99, like, everything had transformed. Because our culture does change slowly. I mean, think of, you know, images, how long it took for there to be African-American filmmakers who, you know, get big studio films. It hasn't happened quickly, even though we could all see, the studios could all see that the numbers were there.
Jenny, thanks so much for calling in. We really appreciate
it. I love it so much.
Thank you so much. Patricia in Queens, Patricia, am I saying it right? In Queens, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. Can you hear me?
I can hear you fine. You have a 1990s story?
Yes, I do. In the late 1990s, I was and still am in New York, and I was new. You know, I was in the country for about 3 years. I was in my late teens, starting college. I came out as bi at that time. It was very contentious to be out as bi in such a politicized time. But I thought that being out was the political gesture of the era. So there I am, kind of doing what I think I should be doing and being really grateful for living in a city where I could be out as bi, whereas being from another country where it would not, in a rural place in another country where that would not have been so welcome. So it wasn't the most pleasant thing to be out as bi, both in my family and out into the world at that time. And I want to share that because these days when I look at how far we have come. When I look at public figures like Sara Ramirez, who's done a lot for the bi community and who's been so vocal, I'm really grateful. And I feel like we really are at a tipping point that's different from the bisexual tipping point that was hinted at in Time magazine in the early 2000s. But I think we are in a moment of acceptance. And I'm really glad to see Sara at events like World Pride tonight.
Did you
very meaningful for me.
Yeah, that's great. Did you experience any of what some people call biphobia, meaning as a bisexual person, you got it from both straight people and from, you know, gays and lesbians who were not bi?
Absolutely. I think that is not a theory. That is an actual thing that we live every day.
Patricia, thank you so much for calling in. I really appreciate it. And historian Claire Potter from the New School, what were you thinking as you heard that set of calls?
Oh, I was thinking a bunch of things. I think about bisexuality. One of the problems that bisexual women certainly faced was feminism. That within feminism, actually to be very radical was often to be a lesbian, and that lesbians often thought that bisexual women were just playing both sides of the street, that they weren't very serious people, or they were just lying about being lesbians and trying to remain respectable, which was terribly unfair. I think for men, and particularly men of color, bisexuality acquired a real stigma because of AIDS. And the notion that bisexual men were somehow responsible for spreading AIDS to the wider population, which we know is not true, but the stigma against gay men and the lower visibility of people who got AIDS for other reasons meant that bisexuality was seen as this sort of patient zero model of spreading AIDS into the general population. I would also say that as the move toward marriage emerged in the 1990s, you see two things happening with bisexuality. One is people who are interested in gay marriage don't know where to put it, okay? If you're bisexual, what does that actually mean in terms of a monogamous relationship? But the other thing you see, which really lays the foundation for the openness of young people today to be very fluid in their sexual identity, is the emergence of the notion of being queer. And that queerness meant not being normal, but not necessarily taking on a particular identity and allowing yourself to be open to whatever relationships came your way.
And so we see the progression from the big National March on Washington in 1979, which was called the National March on Washington for Lesbian and Gay Rights, that by 1993, when there was another big march, it was called the March on Washington for Lesbian, Gay, and Bi Equal Rights and Liberation. No trans or queer yet, but was the 90s the first decade that the acronym LGBT came in, or was that later?
Well, you see people beginning to use it, and it's because transgender people are becoming much more visible, as bisexual people are, online. So in 1993, the Mozilla browser comes out, and even though lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender people, who often called themselves transsexual then, were meeting in chat rooms online, unless you knew where to find it, it was very difficult to actually find that online group. By 1993, you can just start Googling it,
or searching it.
There wasn't Google yet, right? But you can just
Netscape
search it in your browser, and these communities start to show up. So you really see identities consolidating. And I think transgender as an identity is really a phenomenon of the 1990s for that reason, and it grows very, very quickly after that.
We'll continue with historian Claire Potter and more of your oral history calls, remembering the 90s, as we continue with our series, Prejudice and Pride, decade by decade since Stonewall. It is the 90s today. 212-433-WNYC. More after this. Is in the Heart, sang D-Light in 1990. As we continue with our World Pride Month and Stonewall Anniversary Week series, Prejudice and Pride, decade by decade since Stonewall. Talking with us about LGBT culture in the 90s is Claire Potter, professor of history at the New School and executive editor of Public Seminar. And we continue to take your oral history calls from the 90s. And let's go right to another caller, Chris in Union. You're on WNYC. Chris, thanks so much for calling in.
Thanks for having me.
What do you want to remember from the 90s?
Well, it seems odd since I think that I'm one of the youngest callers to call in about it. I'm 29. And I was born in 1990, but I vividly remember the Disney film Hercules coming out in 1997. And the whole premise of that film was for the main character, Hercules, to just go on this long journey to find people who accepted him for who he was. And he was having a difficult time doing the same thing himself. And I've known that I was trans male since I was three, and clearly I didn't have the vocabulary at the age of three to articulate that. But I knew that, you know, what people were telling me, that girls were supposed to enjoy and dress and act and talk, and how boys were supposed to do something different, I always kind of gravitated more towards what boys were supposed to do. And that film itself was kind of like my pivotal moment in just kind of realizing, like, yeah, I'm trans, I'm a boy, I'm supposed to be a boy, I just have to figure out how to do that. So I was able to start testosterone at the age of 23 after being able to come out to everyone else besides myself, because I think that coming out to yourself is one of the harder steps of being able to just accept who you are for who you are and just be able to learn how to truly love yourself and being able to communicate that to other people.
So while a lot of people were watching Ellen come out in 1997, you were watching Hercules. And the message sunk in over time.
Yeah, it did. I mean, obviously the message was to just kind of like accept who you are. But I saw it in a different way, and I needed it in a different way. It's mm-hmm. not just like, oh, you know, like I have different color eyes than everyone else in my class. Like I'm the only one in my class that knows Spanish or whatever made you feel that you were different and be able to come to terms with that. The thing that I needed most was to be able to just say, like, it's okay that, you know, I'm a boy. And I have to work a little bit harder to get to that point that everyone else sees it besides myself.
Thank you so much for calling, Chris. We really appreciate it. Claire Potter, what an important call.
Yeah, really important call. And one of the things it highlights is that even in the 1990s, the images of LGBT people were so few and far between, and particularly trans people. It really highlights the ways in which we have over time sort of recuperated role models where we could find them. And I think it's really important to note that people build identities, they build selves from all kinds of pieces that they pick up in popular culture, not necessarily adopting something they've just seen. Ellen coming out on her show in 1997 is a hugely important cultural touchstone for lesbians and for the queer community more broadly. It's also important to note that she lost her show the following year. So in order to remember that as a really positive moment in our cultural history, we actually have to forget that her show was taken off the air because of it.
Was it because of it?
Yes, it really was. I mean, there was very shaky support in the network. They filmed the puppy episode on a totally closed set. I actually think the fact that Oprah Winfrey was involved was huge in making it happen. And yet the following year, there was a kind of division at the network that the show had really become something for a niche audience, not for the general public, and they dropped it.
And yet, I don't remember if it was the same network, but Will and Grace came on the air that year, 98.
Sure. What's important about Will and Grace, first of all, is that Will has a female friend who's straight. What's also important, and gay cultural critics talk about this a lot, is on these shows, there's often a closeted, straight-looking character, and then there's a really gay, out-there character who pushes the straight character to sort of be more himself. So that, in some ways, is more of a familiar dynamic. I also think lesbian and trans representation in popular culture is really just much harder for the mainstream media to grasp.
Here's a clip of then Vice President Joe Biden, who, remember, endorsed gay marriage before President Obama did, in 2012, reflecting on Will and Grace in an appearance on Meet the Press.
Take a look at when things really began to change. It was when the social culture changes. I think Will and Grace probably did more to educate the American public than almost anything anybody's ever done so far. And I think people fear that which is different. Now they're beginning to understand.
Biden on Meet the Press on May 6th, 2012. Interesting that he was looking back at Will and Grace, of all things, on Meet the Press.
Absolutely. And also interesting that he didn't talk about AIDS, because actually one of the great openings that AIDS created was for large numbers of people to learn for the first time that they had a gay person in their family, that they worked side by side with a gay person, that there were people dying all around them that they really didn't know. And I think that really shook up the culture. And Will and Grace was a kind of pleasant antidote to that, to sort of mainstream all those feelings and all of that curiosity. But I would say that the discovery of the vast number of Americans, that they did know lots of lesbian and gay people and that they weren't trusted by them enough to have that knowledge, probably made a much bigger impact.
Manny in Brooklyn, you're on WNYC. Hi, Manny.
Hi.
What do you want to remember from the 90s?
So when I was growing up, I'm 32 now, my mom came out as bi, mostly to us, and like other callers have said, you know, there wasn't as much a bisexual culture. It was very much a lesbian culture. Her friends were lesbians. We went to Melissa Etheridge shows, and one girlfriend she had, they were very active. They went and did the Boston AIDS ride together. They went to a first gay pride parade together, and she brought me back freedom rings, which one day I wore to school. I was in second grade. It was 1993, and I got made fun of, and someone called me gay, and I didn't know what that meant, really, because it didn't registered to me that there was really anything different about her dating women as opposed to men. Mm-hmm. She was a single mom, so she dated different people, you know. Mm-hmm. And when she was consoling me, she gave me a speech, which, you know, I still think about today as a thing that, you know, some people have to hear it and a lot of people thankfully don't, which was, you know, some people aren't going to understand what we do and who we love, and we can't share that with everyone. And, you know, that had an impact on me. It was the first time I understood that this was something that not everyone understood, and people may have to feel ashamed, or, you know, that this could be dangerous. You know, this was dangerous to our family, to, you know, what could happen to us if other people found out in our town.
And that line, "we can't share that with everyone," speaks to the constant tension that people anywhere on the LGBTQ spectrum must experience all the time about when to come out to the next person and when to come out to the next person.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. And I never felt like I had to come out because of the environment we created within our family, but there was still greater work to do, you know, with our public.
Man, and thank you so much. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you, Brian.
And Rachel in Manhattan, you're on WNYC. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Brian. I was calling in because when you were talking about Bill Clinton and the Democratic Convention, I was the president of Gay and Lesbian Independent Democrats, and we were the and that was the first time you had LGBT pro, you know, pro LGBT rights signs on the convention floor, and that was because we had hand silkscreened them and taken them out, given them to, we had identified who all the gay delegates were, and we had handed them out so they would be on the convention floor. And that was sort of before you had, in some ways, the mass organizational, I don't know how to quite call it, but like branding of LGBT rights. It was still very much like a grassroots activist effort, but we were also the entity, the professor mentioned Tom Duane, and he was elected out of that club, and the year prior to his election, we had elected Assembly Member Deborah Glick mm-hmm. as the first openly lesbian Assembly Member, and she was actually the person who got the LGBT Civil Rights Bill passed. Mm-hmm. up in the New York State Assembly and then Senate and then finally signed into law.
And still so, in office, Deborah
yeah.
Glick.
And Chris Quinn came out of that club. I mean, Chris was there helping us silkscreen. And there was a lot of overlap also. You were just discussing the AIDS movement, people coming out or being sort of having to come out because they became sick and, you know, people understanding that there were so many more gay people around them than they had previously realized. I think that's true, but I also think one of the things that really gets overlooked in terms of the power of the sort of the accelerating power of the LGBT movement is that a lot of powerful white men who got sick or had people, their friends or lovers get sick, all of a sudden realized when they got AIDS or somebody they loved got AIDS was how vulnerable they were. Mm-hmm. They hadn't experienced that vulnerability mm-hmm. except in one tiny slice of their life, mm-hmm. and it really radicalized them. And so you had this very powerful, you know, this socially powerful and politically powerful group, mm-hmm. And it crossed parties, and, you know, there were lots of people within the Republican right. Party, too, who experienced this. And right. I think that is also part of why LGBT rights sort of took off in some ways more powerfully than, you know, say, women's rights did in the 90s.
Great telling of that, Rachel. Thank you so much. We're almost out of time, but I want to sneak in Michelle in Brooklyn, who's got one more cultural reference and personal relevance to that cultural reference, I think, from the 90s. Michelle, you're on WNYC. Hi.
Hi. I just wanted to bring up the show My So-Called Life, which was happening in sometime in the 90s, and which was like a, you know, a huge thing. And the character Ricky, who was gay, and just being able to, like, see, like, the show that I idolized, and also that I had a crush on Claire Danes at the time, and that it was like, okay, like, maybe that's okay, maybe there's a world where this kind of thing can exist outside of my, you know, conservative little bubble in the South that I grew up in, and it was really encouraging.
Great. We just speed Googled it, and my so-called life was 1994 and 95, just for the record. Michelle, thank you so much. And Claire Potter, a closing thought. I see all these emotions on your face as we're cutting through all these callers.
Yeah, well, that's because I still have a crush on Claire Danes. But the 1990s is really a turning point, and it's a point when people are still fighting. And it's also a point when younger people are fighting an older generation. All those wonderful out gay politicians were being mentioned. I was sitting here thinking about all the politicians who were in the closet, really important people who were not actually coming out and making themselves visible as gay people were fighting AIDS and fighting for rights and so on. So I think the 1990s is best thought about as a kind of mixed bag. And that moment when Ellen comes out is so beautiful. We didn't talk about the fact that it's a laugh line when she says, I'm gay. And that's because what we can't see over the radio is when the word comes out of her mouth, she sort of lurches forward, and there's a microphone in the airport that she speaks into, and it blasts all over the airport. It's not a private thing. So Ellen's coming out is what she has always feared, which is everyone will know. And grappling with the everyone will know and thinking about that as a positive thing is really the theme of the 1990s.
Layers and layers in that moment on Ellen.
Yeah.
Claire Potter, professor of history at the New School and executive editor of Public Seminar, thank you so much for coming on.
Thanks for having me, Brian. It's so fun.
And tomorrow we'll continue with our series, Prejudice and Pride, decade by decade since Stonewall, with the aughts. It's the music.